Perhaps your most important responsibility as an adult is to achieve financial independence for yourself and for your family. Aside from the practical, tangible benefits of having all the money you need, there are even more important reasons for obtaining financial freedom. Earlier in this program, we talked about the law of control, which simply says that you feel good about yourself to the degree to which you feel you are in control of your own life. There is perhaps no single factor that will rob you of a feeling of control more than feeling that you don't have enough money to pay your bills and to support your lifestyle. We said in the last session that the most basic human need is for security, for freedom from fear of poverty, of want, of dependence, and of being destitute. The fear of poverty and the fear of failure associated with it causes more unhappiness and more underachievement than perhaps any other single factor. For both men and women in America today, single or married, the achievement of financial independence is the critical issue in whether or not they become everything they're capable of becoming. If a person is worried about money all the time, he never has a chance to enjoy the higher, finer things of life. We also know that financial independence, riches, begins with a state of mind. Becoming wealthy starts with a goal, accompanied by affirmations, visualization, and emotionalization. Repeat it over and over again until the goal is driven deep into your subconscious mind, where it then activates all the mental laws that we discussed in earlier sessions. Financial freedom is only possible when you accept complete responsibility for your financial condition, when you absolutely refuse to make excuses, rationalizations, or justifications for the situation that you find yourself in with regard to money. The acceptance of personal responsibility for everything that you accomplish comes before any meaningful and constructive change or improvement can take place. The inability to delay gratification is the number one reason why people worry about money all their lives and then retire poor. The inability to refrain from spending everything you make and a little bit more besides will more than anything else guarantee that you end up worrying about money endlessly. The flip side of this equation is that the ability to delay gratification, the ability to withhold and refrain from spending in the short term so that you can enjoy the feeling of pride, confidence, and self-esteem that goes with financial independence in the long term, is the number one reason people achieve financial independence in America. The law of accumulation says that every great achievement in human life is an accumulation of hundreds, if not thousands, of little efforts and sacrifices that no one ever sees or appreciates. A great career is preceded by hundreds and thousands of hours of hard work and preparation to become excellent at what you do. Financial independence is preceded by small efforts of saving and sacrifice, repeated hundreds, perhaps thousands of times, with the knowledge that these efforts will eventually accumulate a large amount of money that will enable you to retire wealthy and never have to worry about money again. The law of attraction says that like attracts like. With regard to money, you've heard it said that it takes money to make money. The fact is that when you begin to put aside a little money, that money begins to radiate a magnetic energy that starts to attract more money to you. As long as your attitude towards your money is positive and respectful, you'll find yourself acquiring more and more of it. As you increase your savings and invest your positive emotions in them, you'll find more and more money attracted to you from a variety of unexpected sources. The key to remember is that the more you have, the stronger will be the magnetic force, and the more will come to you. On the other hand, the less you have, and especially if you have none, the less magnetic force there is attracting money into your life, and you'll simply have money problems all the time. The starting point of achieving financial independence is for you to begin saving part of your income every single month. The basic rule for financial accumulation has always been pay yourself first. Each time you get your paycheck, take a certain amount off the top of your check and put it into an account for financial accumulation that you never... Now, what if you're in debt when you begin? What if you don't have enough money to last out the month as it is? Then, you must begin by saving whatever you can. With a little bit of effort, you can easily save 1 or 2% of your net income. You can live on the other 98 or 99%. As you become comfortable with living on 98%, you can increase your savings to 3 or 4% per month, and then later to 5 or 6% per month until you eventually get it up to 10% per month. In the meantime, you can begin to cut down on all unnecessary expenses and commit a minimum percentage of your income each month to reducing your indebtedness. Now you will have two accounts, one account for financial accumulation and one account for debt reduction. In a very short period of time, you'll become accustomed to living on 98% of your income, then 95%, then 90%, then eventually 85%, then 80%, and so on. Many years ago in Winnipeg, Canada, a gentleman came into my two-day seminar at the end of the second day and wanted to ask me for my advice. He said that he wanted to make sure he was doing the right thing with his money. Even though I was tired and he hadn't attended the seminar, I invited him to tell me his story, and this is what he said. He told me that he only had an eighth-grade education, and his wife had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. He worked as a gardener in the summer, and he worked shoveling snow in the winter. His wife worked as a waitress in a cafe. They both earned just slightly above the minimum wage. He said they realized they didn't have a lot going for them, but they had heard that it was a good idea to save at least 10% of their income, so they began doing that every paycheck. After 6 months, they were able to increase it to 15%, and by the end of a year, they were saving 20% of their net income. This was when they were in their early 20s a few years before. Doing this, their combined savings began to add up. Once they'd accumulated about $2,000, they found an opportunity to buy an older house that they could fix up and rent out. They were living in the basement of the home of his in-laws when they bought this house, and when they'd completed the purchase, they moved into the house and worked evenings and weekends renovating and painting. When it was fixed up, they rented it out for a little bit more than the mortgage payment, giving them a positive cash flow on the house of about $50 per month. Over the next 7 or 8 years, they repeated this process, saving their money until they had enough for a down payment, then combining it with the positive cash flow that they were getting from their accumulating number of houses, and then making down payments on new houses. He said that he was now 32 years old and his wife was 30. They had 12 houses, 3 duplexes, 1 triplex, 1 fourplex, and 1 small 12-unit apartment building. They had an equity of more than $500,000 that had built up over the previous 10 years, and they had a positive cash flow of more than $3,000 a month from their various rentals. He said that he just wanted to check with me and ask me if he was doing the right thing with his resources. I assured him that he was definitely doing the right thing. He said that in another 8 or 10 years, they would have a net worth of more than $1 million. Not bad for two people who never finished high school and who still worked at minimum wage jobs. The point that I'm making is that the starting point of their success was when they began to save a certain percentage of their income each month. W. Clement Stone put it very well when he wrote, "If you cannot save money, then the seeds of greatness are not in you." Your blueprint for financial independence begins with your disciplining yourself to live on less than you earn, and eventually to live on a good deal less than you earn. The major psychological benefit of saving money is that it gives you a tremendous feeling of pride, self-respect, and self-esteem. A person who has money in the bank and money in his or her pocket is a very different person from the person who has no savings and who is totally preoccupied with money worries most of the time. In order to become wealthy, you must fight against the almost irresistible power of what has come to be called Parkinson's Law. Parkinson's Law says that expenditures always rise to meet income. This law says that no matter how much you earn, your cost of living tends to rise to absorb every single penny. If your income goes from $1,000 per month to $3,000 per month over a 2 or 3 or 5 year period, if you're not extremely well disciplined, you'll find that your cost of living will rise to the same level and will absorb everything that you're making. Dr. Thomas Stanley of the University of Georgia, who studied many thousands of affluent Americans, concluded that there are two types of people with regard to money. There are those who look like they have a lot of money, and then there are those who really do have a lot of money. His studies concluded that the people who seem to be doing extremely well, driving flashy cars, taking expensive vacations, buying lots of expensive clothes, are usually living just one paycheck ahead of the bill collectors. He said that the really wealthy people in America and most self-made millionaires live on ordinary streets and drive ordinary cars and live very ordinary lifestyles. Perhaps the finest example of this was Sam Walton of Walmart stores, the richest man in America. When he was worth $8.7 billion in 1988, Sam Walton was still driving to work in a pickup truck. Many wealthy men and women drive ordinary cars, even station wagons and vans, because most of their money is busy working for them somewhere else. Many people who look wealthy have all their money invested in symbols of wealth, which are losing value every single day. Now, the three legs of the financial planning stool are savings, insurance, and investments. With regard to savings, your philosophy should be to build what is called a financial fortress. A financial fortress is an amount of money that protects you from the unexpected ups and downs of a dynamic economy. Your minimum goal for savings should be to have between 2 and 6 months' living expenses put aside in a fairly liquid form, such as savings accounts, money market accounts, or a money market mutual fund. When you've reached the point where you have built your financial fortress, when you've got enough so that you can live for 2 to 6 months without worrying about money, you'll have become a totally different person. You will have an aura of unshakable self-confidence and self-assurance that other people will notice immediately. You'll not have to put up with a job or a boss that you don't like, nor will you have to stay working at something simply because you can't afford to quit. You'll be able to choose to do what is best for you. You'll be able to choose the kind of work you want to do and the kind of people you want to work with. You'll be able to choose only to do what you love to do and care about, rather than being forced to do something that has no meaning for you aside from the paycheck. The second part of financial planning is life insurance. The only kind of life insurance that you should buy, and you should only buy life insurance if you are a man or a woman with a family to provide for, is term insurance. Term insurance is much cheaper than any other kind. You can buy it in almost any amount, and it will pay out the face amount of the policy to your estate or to your family should you die unexpectedly. When you become wealthy and you have an estate that you need to protect from estate duties upon your death, that's the time for you to begin to think about permanent insurance, which is insurance that has an equity or cash buildup contained in the premium and which can never be canceled for any reason. But for the time being, until you have a lot of money that you need to protect from the tax collector, you should only buy term insurance and only if you have a family to support. You should buy enough term insurance so that the proceeds from the insurance will enable your family to maintain its standard of living at the current level. If your current income is $25,000 per year, and your family could earn 10% per annum off the proceeds from a life insurance policy, you should have $250,000 worth of term insurance, payable to your spouse as your beneficiary. In the event of your death, this amount would go directly to your spouse, and since it's below the taxable limits, it would go tax-free as part of your estate. The third leg of the financial planning stool is investment. Investments are what will eventually make you wealthy, and it's absolutely essential that you become as wise as a serpent and as clever as a fox with regard to how you invest your money. The first investment that you should take maximum advantage of is a self-directed, tax-sheltered investment such as an IRA, a KEO plan, or if possible, a company pension plan. Even though the amount that you can put into an IRA or a KEO plan is limited, as would be a company pension plan, you should take advantage of these plans and invest every single possible cent that you're allowed to put into them. Money that accumulates in a tax-sheltered plan can grow at a rate of 50 to 100% faster than money that's invested outside of such a plan and which is subject to taxation on every dollar. Your earnings in the form of interest and dividends are fully taxable when they're received by you if they are outside of an IRA or KEO plan. The earnings inside an IRA or KEO plan are tax-deferred. That is, they continue to grow and compound without taxes until you actually take them out of the plan when you retire later on in life. Once you've taken maximum advantage of tax-sheltered investments, there are three other types of investments that you should think about. The first is a money market fund. A money market fund is different from a money market account at your bank in that it is invested more aggressively and it pays a higher rate of interest. Money market funds can be open for as little as $500, and they're available from almost all financial planning organizations. It's very important when you put your money into a money market fund that you read its prospectus and that you make sure that the costs of administration of the fund are no more than 0.5 or 0.75% per year. If they're in excess of that amount in total, you should seek another fund. The time to invest in money market funds is when interest rates or the stock market seem to be unstable and unpredictable. the ideal time to invest in a money market fund is when interest rates are rising, and especially if the prime rate has risen above 9.5 or 9.75%. The prime rate is the lending rate most major banks charge their creditworthy customers. That's the time when you will get your highest and safest return on your savings in a money market fund. The second investment that you can use is a mutual fund. The only kind of mutual fund for you to consider is a no-load mutual fund. A no-load mutual fund is one that charges you no commissions for investing. 100% of the amount that you put in goes to work for you immediately. There's very little difference in the financial performance and rate of growth between a no-load mutual fund and a full-load mutual fund. A full-load mutual fund will charge you as much as 8.5 or 9% commission for the privilege of investing your hard-earned money. That money will be paid to the person who has sold you the investment. It will not be deposited to your account, nor will it be available to you ever again. Your investment will have to grow by 8.5 to 9% just to enable you to get back to even if you pay this kind of a commission when you buy a mutual fund. There are several organizations that offer no-load mutual funds. You can find advertisements for them in the newspaper, in Money Magazine, in mutual fund guides, and you can ask around and get advice from other people you know who are using them. The first rule of investment is always to investigate before you invest. The only thing that is easy about money is losing it. Making money requires patience, fortitude, and never-ending vigilance, even in mutual funds. The time to invest in a stock-based mutual fund is when the prime interest rate is declining or when it's below 9.5%. The rise and fall of the prime rate correlates very closely with economic expansion and recession, with booms and busts in the stock market. When interest rates are low, the cost of capital is low, and therefore businesses rush to invest and increase their productive capacity and their profits. When interest rates are high, companies cut back on expansion plans. They maintain or cut back on their numbers of workers, and they decrease the amount of economic activity or opportunities that they take advantage of. A mutual fund is a fund invested in by thousands of individual investors such as yourself. This pool of funds is then invested in a broad cross-section of stocks traded on the major stock markets of the United States or other countries. A mutual fund is managed by professional money managers, people who watch the market 40, 50, and 60 hours per week. These financial professionals have available to them enormous quantities of information that individual investors simply could not acquire or have access to. When a mutual fund invests in a broad selection of stocks, your risk is also spread over a broad selection of stocks. Many well-managed mutual funds increase in value greatly in excess of the general market. When the market slumps, as it did in October 1987, most mutual funds do not decline as much as the overall market averages, or as do individual stocks. A no-load mutual fund professionally managed in a broad assortment of carefully selected stocks is one of the best investments for financial growth when the prime rate is below 9.5% and declining. The third type of investment available to you for financial accumulation, once you have your 2 to 6 months' worth of savings put aside, is bond mutual funds, also no load. The best time to invest in a bond fund is when all indications are that interest rates have peaked and are declining. As interest rates decline from their recent highs, the value of the individual shares in the bond fund increases. Since the bond funds are composed of securities bearing fixed rates of return, as the average interest rate in the marketplace declines, the return on these bonds, relatively speaking, goes up. Let me explain. Let's say that you buy a single bond with a $1,000 face value and it pays 10% interest per annum. Your return will be $100 per annum, or a return on investment of 10%. Now let's say that the prime interest rate drops to 8%. 8% now becomes the multiple at which people will buy bonds. New bonds will be issued at 8%, and outstanding bonds that are paying 10% will increase in value to about $1,200 per $1,000 of face amount. By paying $1,200 for the bond, the return to the investor will be 8%. This is why you always buy bonds when market interest rates are declining. Every point of decline in the prime rate increases the value of the bond fund by as much as 10%. To summarize then, the very best investment vehicle for financial accumulation for the average person is a no-load mutual fund, either a stock fund, or a bond fund, or a money market fund. What is the best single investment? Well, there's no answer to this question. At one point in the economy, one investment will be better than all others. As the economy and interest rates change, another investment will be better. You must watch your investments carefully, and you must take 100% responsibility for every decision you make with regard to how you allocate your investment funds. No one else can make your investment decisions for you. One of the most successful businessmen in America was once asked about the philosophy he had that had enabled him to acquire so many companies and so much money. He said that he had just two rules. Rule number one, he said, was, don't lose money. Rule number two was, he said, whenever you are tempted, refer back to rule number one. A Japanese proverb says that making money is like digging sand with a pin, whereas losing money is like pouring water into the sand. Money is hard to earn and easy to lose. If all you did throughout the course of your working lifetime was to save 10% or more of your income and put it away and let it accumulate at interest, that alone would make you financially independent. When you lose money for any reason, you are also losing the number of months and years that it took you to accumulate that money. You're actually losing a part of your life, the amount of your life that you had to exchange for the amount of money that you lost. Whenever someone reaches the point where he or she feels that he or she can afford to lose a little money in an investment, you can be sure of one thing. That person is going to lose not only a little, but probably a lot of money. Your attitude must always be, don't lose money. All serious money in the United States is conservative money. It is what economists call risk-averse money. Serious people with serious money continually seek for ways to increase their money by minimizing risk, not by seeking for risk. Successful entrepreneurs and business people are not risk-takers. The successful ones are risk-avoiders. That's how they became successful. A basic rule for investment is to spend at least as much time in investigating an investment as you spend earning the money that you're prepared to invest. There is nothing that takes the place of research. Many financial advisors who are selling various investments are not particularly well off themselves, and in addition, they often know very little about what they're recommending. Your attitude toward financial accumulation should be that when you put the money aside, you never spend it, not for any reason. You don't put the money aside for a rainy day. You don't save up so that you can buy a motorhome or a boat. You set up different financial accumulation accounts for those things. Your savings and investment funds are put away, never to be touched, to grow and multiply over the course of the years until they yield you the financial independence you desire. The very best way to make money, and then make even more money, is to keep on doing the same thing that you're doing and to do it extremely well. You must develop a lifelong philosophy of holding on to your money carefully once you've earned it. And here's another part of your financial fortress planning. Wealthy men and women in America have low debt or no debt. The only kind of debt that they allow is debt for investments into assets that are paying back more than the cost of money they've borrowed. The only kind of real estate they own is real estate where mortgages and all expenses are serviced by the rent that comes from the real estate. The only time they borrow to invest in their companies is when they can earn a higher rate of return in their companies than they have to pay for the money in the first place. As a general philosophy, one of the wisest things that you can do if you want to enjoy peace of mind and become financially independent is to make a plan, starting today, to pay off all your debts and to live debt-free, aside from your home mortgage and perhaps your car. As a general rule, you should never borrow for your expenses of consumption, for food, rent, transportation, clothes, and other things that you use up on a monthly and yearly basis. You should lease or rent assets that depreciate or lose value, and you should only borrow to invest in assets that go up in value as time passes, in excess of the cost of the money or the interest rate. You have three periods in your life with regard to money. The first 25 years are called your learning years. During this time, you acquire your basic education and your basic ability to earn money. The next 40 years are called your earning years. These are the years where you work the hardest and increase your income the most. The last 20 years are called your yearning years. These are the years when you look forward to retirement, either a comfortable retirement or a retirement accompanied by financial problems and worries. It's helpful for you to know that most people make the greatest amount of money in their lives after the age of 45. It's only after this age that your expenses for raising your family begin to diminish and you're being paid the highest amounts that you've ever earned. It's during this time that you can begin to save 20 and 30 and even 40% of your income to run up your savings and investment accounts to their maximum prior to your age of retirement. Nonetheless, even if you are in your late teens or early 20s, for the sake of your character, your peace of mind, and for your future, you must begin to save and put money aside. People who say silly things such as, "I'm not here for a long time, I'm here for a good time," are people who have a failure attitude and who will surely be in serious financial trouble before their careers are over. Wealth in America can be defined as simply cash flow from other sources. You're only wealthy to the degree to which you do not have to go to work each day in order to support your current standard of living. Wealthy people are those who can stop working with no interruption in their lifestyles. Your primary job during your financial accumulation years is to build up a portfolio of assets that yield you an income which is eventually greater than the income that you earn from working. At that point, you can stop working if you desire and begin to spend more of your time managing your investments. Here are a couple of important points with regard to money. First, there is no such thing as easy money. The hardest money that you will ever get will initially look like easy money. And second, there are no investments without uncertainty. There is a certain amount of risk in everything that you do in life. Your job is to minimize the risk wherever possible. Never invest in gold, silver, or precious metals. The worst of all investments over the last 25 years has been gold. Gold gives you no rate of return. It is inert. There are many people who make a lot of money by selling gold, silver, and precious metals, but the people who purchase them very seldom make anything. In addition, never, never purchase an investment over the phone unless it's from a known and respected company. The United States today is full of confidence games and scams being sold over the phone to unsuspecting investors. These people often work out of motels and bucket shops, and they move from place to place as fast as the police become aware of them. Their favorite swindles are in commodities, precious metals, and penny stocks. If someone calls you to offer any one of these, hang up so fast that it makes their ears burn. I have met so many people who've lost so much money and so many years of hard work to these swindles that it almost breaks my heart. Don't you be one of them. Also, don't invest in antiques, Persian carpets, coins, or stamps unless you're a full-time expert in those fields. There are as many of those investments decreasing in value as there are increasing on any given day. Fully 90% of all original artworks, paintings, sculptures, and so on, of any kind, never sees its original retail sales price again. From the time you purchase it, it declines in value, usually by 80% or more. These are not good investments for a person who is serious about becoming rich. These are only things that you buy when you're already wealthy, and then you buy them for their beauty and for the pleasure that they give you, but not as an investment. Don't invest in oil and gas or mining stocks, and don't invest in commodities, even with reputable commodity dealers. Commodities are the most dangerous and the most volatile of all investments, and virtually everyone who invests in commodities for any period of time loses almost everything that they put in. Your goal must be to achieve financial independence as rapidly as you can. This must be your driving force with regard to money. You must assiduously avoid the pleasure of short-term consumption in exchange for long-term financial security. You must discipline yourself to begin and maintain a regular savings program from now right through to the end of your life. You must train your children and members of your family in this discipline so that they very early develop the mental mindset that leads to financial success. Now here's an exercise for you. Sit down and write out a plan for financial accumulation and a series of milestones or goals for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years. Launch your plan by reaching into your pocket and putting as much as you can into a jar or piggy bank. Open a wealth-building savings account and start putting something into it from every paycheck. Finally, put yourself on a budget. Make a habit of writing down in a small notebook every penny you spend on a daily basis. Each week, take some time to review your expenditures with a view toward reducing your consumption and increasing your savings. If you can discipline yourself to do all of this, if you can delay gratification, you will be well on the way to financial freedom and to the peace of mind that you desire. Once upon a time, a man was walking along and came across four bricklayers working on a job. He stopped and asked the first bricklayer, "What are you doing?" To this, the first bricklayer answered, "I'm laying bricks." He went on to the second bricklayer and asked him the same question, "What are you doing?" The second bricklayer replied that, "I'm building a wall." When he asked the third bricklayer what he was doing, the reply he got was, "I'm helping in the construction of a church." When he asked the same question of the fourth bricklayer, the fourth bricklayer stopped, looked up at him, and with pride in his voice replied, "I am helping in the construction of a monument to God that will last for 1,000 years. This simple story illustrates the difference between people at the four different stages of their work lives and often in their personal lives as well. Everyone goes through the first stage of finishing their education and starting work as an employee. As a new employee, you begin with limited skills and you gradually learn what you need to know in order to do the job. As you become a better and better employee, more knowledgeable and more skilled, you eventually reach the point where you're given responsibility over someone or several other people. In other words, at the upper end of the scale of being an employee, you enter the lower part of the scale of being a supervisor. The bricklayer who is merely laying bricks is a person with the attitude of an employee. All he could see was the work that was in front of him. The employee does not see or think that what he's doing is connected to anything else in a big way. As a supervisor, however, you begin to see a bigger picture. In this case, building a wall versus laying bricks. As a supervisor, if you continue to learn and grow and become more competent and more effective, you'll move up the ladder of supervision until eventually you become a manager. The upper end of the scale of being a supervisor becomes the lower end of the scale of being a manager. The second bricklayer, the one who was building a wall, is the person with a supervisor mentality. He has a slightly bigger picture of the work, but he can't connect it with much outside of his area of responsibility. When you become a manager and you learn and grow and develop your skills, becoming more and more competent, you will move up the ladder of management until you become a leader. The top of the scale of management, therefore, becomes the lower rung of the ladder of leadership. The third bricklayer, the one who sees that he's building a church, is the equivalent of the manager. He can see how his work fits into the total picture of the results that the organization is trying to achieve. The fourth bricklayer, the one who sees himself as part of a project to build a monument to God which will last for 1,000 years, is the leader. This is the person who has a vision of something much greater than that of the average person, the employee, the supervisor, or the manager. And this becomes the distinguishing characteristic of the exceptional man or woman. The fact that he has a vision or a mission that is uplifting and inspiring, something that motivates and drives him and others toward the accomplishment of things beyond the ordinary. There have been more than 3,000 articles written on the subject of leadership, analyzing and the first quality of leadership is a sense of mission, a feeling of being committed to the achieving of a big and exciting goal. There's never been a time in human history when leadership has been more necessary and more in demand. Today, more than ever, we need men and women of vision, courage, and integrity to lead our families, to lead our communities, to lead our organizations, and to set examples for others to follow. We need leaders to take us into the next decade and the next century. We need leaders to solve the pressing problems facing humanity and to achieve the great goals that are possible for more people today than at any other time since humankind emerged on this planet. Leadership today, more than anything else, is an expression of the whole person. Men and women who evolve to positions of leadership are usually men and women who have developed themselves in a superior fashion through rigid adherence to a high code of moral standards and by relentless self-discipline and persistence in the face of adversity. Leaders are those men and women who have taken control of their own evolution and brought themselves up to a higher level of consciousness and a higher level of effectiveness. The law of attraction explains what I'm talking about. As you become a better and better person, working on yourself continually, you attract into your life and experience opportunities to lead. You draw these opportunities to you as iron filings are drawn to a magnet. The law of correspondence says that your outer world of results will correspond to your inner world of preparation. As you do the things and say the words and think the thoughts and engage in the actions consistent with leadership, you get more and more opportunity to actually demonstrate your leadership ability. If the first key quality of leadership is a sense of mission or vision, the second key quality of leadership is integrity. We've discussed integrity at length before. In terms of leadership, it means that people can take you at your word. People can trust you and believe in you. People can relax, assured that your behavior and your actions will be consistent and predictable. You won't be one person one day and another person the next day. People can relax with you as a leader because they know that you are completely reliable in everything you do. The third quality leaders have in common, in addition to vision and integrity, is the quality of courage. Leaders have the courage to set high and challenging goals for themselves and for their organizations and for their areas of responsibility. Leaders have the courage to take calculated risks and move forward in the face of uncertainty. Leaders have the ability to make plans and stick by the plans even when others are losing their nerve and their resolve. Leaders have what is called courageous patience. They have the ability to stay the course, to endure in the face of adversity and difficulty, often when everyone else feels that the course of action should be abandoned. Leaders are, as much as anything, people who are willing to accept responsibility for results. In the final analysis, leadership is the ability to get things done. Harold S. Janin, in his excellent book, Managing, summarized it simply by saying, "Leaders lead." Leaders translate their visions into plans of constructive action, and they lead the action. They dare to go forward. They are intensely result-oriented. They keep a very clear eye on what it is they're supposed to accomplish, and they stay at it relentlessly until the goal is achieved. Leaders never try to hand off the responsibility to someone else. They're always willing to step forward and accept the blame when things go wrong, and simultaneously, to give the credit to others when things go right. Leaders also have the ability to plan strategically. They have the ability to think through in advance what it is they want to accomplish and the best way to go about accomplishing it. They see the big picture. They take a good deal of time to gather information and reflect on the information. They set strategic goals, and then they analyze and identify the obstacles that stand between them and their goals, and the likely consequences of any course of action they may take. They plan for success, and they plan for temporary setbacks. They always have an alternative plan if their first plan of action isn't successful. They never bet the farm on a single roll of the dice. They keep their options open, and they develop alternatives, no matter how positive the outlook for a particular decision may be. Leaders are intensely realistic. They do not allow themselves the luxury of self-delusion. They face reality as it is, not as they wish it could be. They're willing to confront their fears and deal in a straightforward manner with problems involving other people. They don't hide their heads and run for cover when conflict and difficulties arise. For example, many companies run into financial trouble when they're growing. Even large companies experience financial crises during the course of their economic lives. When this happens, one of the unpleasant eventualities is that bill collectors and bankers begin to call, worried about getting their money. In a company that's run by a true leader, he or she will turn toward this danger personally. He or she will not assign the difficult negotiations or decisions to subordinates. This leader will accept the burden of responsibility and will place himself or herself between the banker or supplier and his or her staff so that his people don't have to take the heat. There's an old saying that some are born to leadership, some grow into leadership, and others have leadership thrust upon them. The fact is that leadership in organizations is often situational. One person may turn out to be an excellent leader in a particular organization at a particular time, within the context of a particular external environment and internal set of needs. But if this person moves to another company or position, he or she may fail dismally as a leader. The new situation may not be what is necessary to draw out the best qualities of this particular individual. One of your major responsibilities to yourself is to become a leader in your personal and your work life. It's your responsibility to commit yourself to the cause of your ongoing development. It is one of your duties to become a superior human being and to do the things that will draw the mantle of leadership toward you. When I talked about your self-concept earlier in this program, I explained that your self-ideal is that part of your self-concept that defines the person you want most to be like. Your self-ideal is made up of a combination of all the qualities of men and women, living or dead, that you have most admired and that you most want to be like in the present. Leaders have very high personal self-ideals. So a starting point of becoming more of a leader is to develop these ideals in yourself by identifying with other men and women who have grown into leadership positions. Most leaders are made, not born. Most men and women who rise to positions of leadership usually do over many years, evolving gradually from being an inexperienced employee up the ladder of personal evolution into leadership and leadership responsibilities. And there are certain things that you can do to speed up this process. One study of men and women who became leaders later in life found that almost all of them spent a good deal of time when they were growing up reading the stories and autobiographies of other leaders. This is a course of personal development that I strongly recommend to you. There are many fine biographies of men and women, such as Albert Schweitzer, Mother Teresa, Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Robert E. Lee, Florence Nightingale, Ulysses S. Grant, Clara Barton, and Emily Dickinson. When you read the life stories of men and women who have done exceptional things, two things begin to happen to you. First, you learn that they had problems to contend with that were often much worse than yours. They faced obstacles, adversities, and difficulties that in some cases seemed to be almost insurmountable. They had many disappointments and temporary defeats, all of them, sometimes total failure. However, they kept believing in themselves and their abilities. They kept working on themselves and pushing forward, and eventually they achieved the kind of greatness that made them worthy of our study today. The second benefit that you get from reading the stories of great men and women is that you unconsciously begin to absorb the qualities that they have and which you most admire. Without even being aware of it, if you read about men and women of courage and tenacity, you begin to identify with and see yourself as a person of courage and tenacity. You begin to make decisions in your day-to-day life based on how you think that these heroes and heroines might behave themselves under the same circumstances. You become more of a leader when you think of how other leaders handled your particular situation. In a few months of reading about leaders, you will find that your voice, your body language, your behavior, and your self-image will all be changing in the direction of your becoming a better and more admirable person. One of the qualities of leaders at home or at work is that leaders see themselves as role models. They realize that it's up to them to set the standard, to behave in such a way that other people will look up to them and imitate their behaviors. Acting the part, walking the walk, talking the talk, behaving exactly as if you were already the person that you desire to be is one of the most powerful ways to program your subconscious mind with new attitudes and new behaviors. Leaders realize that they don't have the luxury of letting it all hang out. When you aspire to leadership, you must keep your doubts and fears to yourself. You're no longer allowed the privilege of expressing your emotions, of blowing up or getting upset or telling people what you really think. When you begin moving toward leadership, you become far more aware of the impact of your behavior on the thoughts and feelings of others, especially those who look up to you for guidance and direction. Your children are powerfully affected by the example that you set for them as a parent. Your spouse is also influenced in his or her character development by the example that you set when you're together. One of the kindest things you can do for your family is to see yourself as the leader and to walk and talk and act as a true leader when you're with them. Because leaders have integrity, they are always real in their relationships. Now, I'm not suggesting that you should pretend to be something that you're not. However, if you're really honest with yourself, true to yourself, you'll tend to be natural and relaxed with other people. You'll not put on airs or pretensions. You'll just allow your personality to flow, knowing that if you're living your life consistent with your highest ideals, your natural personality is an expression of the very best person you can possibly be. Be yourself. It's the only role that you can play with complete honesty and sincerity and with no further practice. All leaders have enough confidence in themselves to allow their true selves to shine through. A critical quality of leadership is self-esteem, a high self-regard. Throughout this program, you've already learned a variety of techniques that you can use to help build and maintain high levels of self-esteem and self-acceptance. The more you like and respect yourself, the more likely it is that you will evolve and grow into a leadership position. The more you like yourself, the more willing you will be to accept responsibility without making excuses or blaming anyone else for your problems. The more you like yourself, the more courage you will have in that you will not fear failure or rejection. You will recognize that everybody makes mistakes and that no failure is ever final. Leaders take a different approach toward mistakes and temporary setbacks than most non-leaders do because they have high self-esteem. For example, they never use the word failure. Instead, leaders, because they have this high self-esteem, because they recognize the need to maintain high levels of self-confidence and self-esteem in others, always refer to temporary setbacks as learning experiences or temporary glitches. Effective leaders, because they have high self-esteem, allow their staff and their children to make honest mistakes. They then help these people to learn and grow from their mistakes. They choose the future over the past. Instead of saying, "What happened?" and "Who did it?" they say instead, "Where do we go from here?" or "What do we do now?" Instead of blaming, they put the past aside and they focus on the future. They begin looking toward whatever positive and constructive action they can take from this moment forward. They are intensely solution-oriented rather than blame-oriented. There are many reasons why you should aspire to a position of leadership. One of these reasons is that it is a vital step on your pathway to financial independence and the achievement of personal wealth. Fully 10% of all self-made millionaires in America achieve their wealth while working for another company or organization. While they worked for someone else, they were extremely good followers before they became good leaders. They became very good at their work. They developed their leadership qualities within the context of the requirements of the organization, and they were eventually paid very well. They carefully salted the money away, investing conservatively and letting it accumulate with the miracle of compound interest. They were paid high salaries because they were worth it. They were intensely result-oriented. They were continually looking for faster, better, more efficient ways of getting the results upon which the success of the company depended. They used the niche strategy, which I discussed earlier, to work themselves into vital positions in the company, positions that had a major impact on cash flow or on the success of the enterprise. They continually worked on themselves to upgrade their skills and their ability to contribute. They knew that their earning capacity, their abilities to get results for their organization, was the most important investment they could make, and they never stopped investing in themselves. So, if you want to rise to the top of your organization, the starting point is to develop a vision of the wonderful life and career that you can have. Set big goals and high standards for yourself. Make detailed plans of action to accomplish them. Then, when you've done it for yourself, turn to your organization and begin to think in terms of the great things that your company can accomplish and the areas where you can help your company achieve its goals. Look around you in your company and seek for opportunities to accept responsibility and take charge of getting important results, like a leader. Volunteer for assignments that are important to your boss, but that others are reluctant to take on. Be willing to move if the company transfers you. Be willing to risk your career for an opportunity to perform in an exemplary fashion. Napoleon Bonaparte was once asked what he considered to be the qualities of a great general. And he replied by saying, "A great general is one who has the ability to plan strategically, organize every detail of the enterprise, and then go boldly into action with a complete willingness to perish gloriously in a great cause." You don't find many wishy-washy leaders. All leaders who are worthy of the title seem to be men and women of great intensity and conviction. They have a very strong belief in themselves and in their ability to get the job done. They become virtually unstoppable when they start to move toward the achievement of something that's important to them and their organization. In addition, they're extremely loyal to their companies and to their bosses. This combination of loyalty to the organization and to its objectives, combined with intensity of purpose, enables them to push through resistance and over obstacles that would tend to stop the average person. You develop leadership qualities and leadership opportunities in direct proportion to your willingness and ability to step up to the plate and hit home runs. The more and better results that you take responsibility for, the more you're going to accomplish and the more opportunities you're going to have to perform at an even higher level. You can stay on the payroll of another company for your entire life, and you can still become rich, but only if you move up the ladder into a leadership position and set a vision and goal for yourself to become the very best in your field. One definition of leadership is that leadership is the ability to determine the area of excellence. Leaders are those who set the mission of the organization and who articulate to the others where and how you're going to become superior and what you're going to do that makes you a winner in the marketplace. Leaders in business are those who clearly define the area of competitive advantage toward which they aspire and then focus all of the energies on the organization toward becoming very, very good in a critical market-related area. And this brings us to a vital part of mission, vision, and leadership, and that is the central role of service in the achievement of personal greatness. In an earlier session, I said that the need for meaning and purpose is often the greatest single need of the human being. Men and women will die for a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. If we achieve all kinds of monetary rewards, but we have no sense of purpose, no reason for being alive, our external accomplishments will give us no lasting pleasure or satisfaction. We are structured in such a way that we achieve meaning and purpose in our lives by what is called transcendence. Transcendence is the experience of rising above the tangible and material elements of our lives. To achieve transcendence, we must seek something bigger and higher than ourselves to be committed to. The only way that you and I can achieve transcendence is by losing ourselves in service to some great cause. And the only great cause that can motivate you continuously is something that has to do with uplifting, enhancing, and improving the lives of other people. I said earlier that human beings are lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient, and that they seek the fastest and easiest way to get the things they want right now with little or no concern for secondary considerations. The wonderful thing is that we as human beings are also designed in such a way that we can never really achieve pleasure from anything that we accomplish unless we feel that we're making a contribution to mankind. We need to feel that we are making a difference to someone. All great men and women have felt that in some way their lives belong not to themselves, but to the world and to humanity at large. They felt that they had a sense of destiny, that they were put on this earth to do something special with their lives, something that would somehow help and uplift the lives of others. To be a leader is to be able to lead yourself in service to others. To be a great leader is to be able to articulate a vision of service to other people that other people can buy into and which motivates and inspires them to give of their best as well. A great leader is one who creates enthusiasm by the value and importance of the mission to which the enterprise is dedicated. He is the person with a commitment to becoming excellent at helping other people get the things they need to improve their lives. Now, there's another reason why you would want to be an excellent leader in your company or in your business. All founders of successful business enterprises were at one time excellent leaders for other people in other businesses. More than 50% of adult Americans dream of someday starting their own businesses within the free enterprise system. Those who will succeed with the greatest predictability will be those who have, through their own efforts, their own vision, their own courage, their own integrity, and their own willingness to accept responsibility for results, perform brilliantly with other companies. Working for another company, a larger company, is the perfect training ground for starting and building your own successful business, for developing the qualities of leadership. One of the more important aspects of leadership is the ability to influence and to persuade others. Good leaders are excellent, low-pressure salespeople. They are persistent and tenacious, and they have a wonderful ability to get others to go along with them. This quality of leadership is also the characteristic of the successful entrepreneur, as we'll talk about in greater detail in a later session. However, if you aspire to wealth and financial independence, one of the fastest ways upward and onward is by becoming excellent as a leader wherever you are and in whatever you are doing at the present moment. One of the forms of leverage that you will need in order to achieve your goals, aside from money, knowledge, and skill, is OPE, or other people's efforts. You can never achieve very much by simply depending on your own physical and mental efforts. In order to reach the stars, you need to multiply yourself by the efforts of other people. You need to put other people to work and to make money from their work by being the person who has organized the resources that makes their job possible. This is one of the key roles of a business person at any level of the enterprise, and especially a business person who wants to start and build his or her own business. There are several leadership principles which are important for you to have as points of reference. The first is leadership by values. Leaders tend to be those men and women who ascribe to the highest standards for themselves and for their organizations. They believe in honesty, quality, excellence, service, and caring for the individual. To the leader, these values are inviolable, and the leader is adamant in upholding these values in every activity that goes on within his or her area of authority. The second principle is management by responsibility. Good leaders are those who, first of all, accept full responsibility for the results of the enterprise, with no excuses. They then manage by delegating specific areas of responsibility to individual staff members, and then by carefully monitoring and supervising their work to assure that the job gets done on time and at the proper standard of quality. The third leadership principle is leadership by objectives. Good leaders are those who set very clear goals and objectives for themselves and for every part of the enterprise. They express absolute clarity with regard to what they expect, and everyone knows what they're expected to do, when they're expected to do it, and to what standard of quality the work is to be done. In my experience, probably 80% of people working today under average managers are vague or uncertain about exactly why it is they're on the payroll. The fourth leadership principle is leadership by strength. Good leaders are those who are able to concentrate on the strengths in every situation. They concentrate on their own strengths, developing themselves where they're strong, and taking steps to compensate in the areas where they're weak. Leaders refuse to deploy themselves in areas where they can't do an excellent job as a result of their unique talents and abilities. Then, by extension, leaders deploy their other human resources in the same way. They carefully select people for specific job assignments, taking time to match the talents and abilities of the individual to the needs of the situation, and always capitalizing on strengths rather than compensating for weaknesses. If you're in sales, working on your own as a guerrilla fighter in the free enterprise system, leadership skills are necessary, if not essential, to your success. When you see yourself as a leader in your field, when you think about yourself as a leader, and when you identify with other leaders living and dead, you find yourself doing a far better job for your customers than you ever would under any other circumstances. The very best leaders in every field, including and especially the field of sales, are those who look upon themselves as exceptional men and women and they set very high standards for themselves. They continuously look at setting a positive example for others. They see themselves as role models for more junior salespeople to look up to and copy. They carry themselves with pride and dignity. As top salespeople, leaders in their field, they have high levels of self-esteem, and they accept high levels of responsibility for the sales results that they've been hired to accomplish. Even though they work largely on their own, top salespeople are leaders in every sense of the word. Here are six keys to help you become a better leader, starting right now. The first key is desire. To rise to a position of leadership, you must really want the experience and responsibility of being a leader. In the absence of this intense desire for a higher position in life, very little can happen for you. The second key is to make a decision right now to pay the price of leadership and to continue paying it until you rise to the greatest height of which you are capable. Be willing to always do more than you're paid for. The third key is determination. Determination is the resolution in advance that you will keep on keeping on until you achieve your goals and discharge your responsibilities. The fourth key to becoming a leader is discipline, which means self-mastery and self-control. It means that you continually use your willpower to do what you know you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. The fifth key to becoming a leader is for you to study leadership and leaders in books and on tapes. As you study and read and listen, think of how you can apply what you're learning to your daily life. The sixth key to leadership is for you to, as Vince Lombardi said, become brilliant on the basics. Most leaders achieve their positions because of their reputations for doing excellent work at whatever job is assigned to them. Identify the success factors in your work, and then commit yourself to becoming the best in each one of them. This will begin attracting the attention of people who can help you rise to an even higher leadership position. Remember, what companies and countries and institutions need today are courageous leaders, visionaries of courage and integrity, who are committed to creating an exciting future for themselves and others. You have within yourself right now the capacity to evolve and grow as a leader and to make a real difference in the world. One thing you know for sure about yourself is that no matter what you've accomplished so far, there is still far more that you can do. And aspiring to a high position of leadership is one of the greatest and noblest causes to which you can dedicate yourself. Now here's an exercise for you. Make a list of at least five leaders, living or dead, whom you admire. Next to the names of these men or women, write the qualities of each of them that you most aspire to. Organize your list of qualities by priorities from 1 to 10 or 15 or 20, depending upon how many qualities you identify. Select two qualities that you feel are your strongest qualities right now. Then, being brutally honest with yourself, identify the two qualities that you admire in others where you feel you are currently the weakest. Next, make a plan, a single written paragraph that describes what you are going to do to begin developing the qualities where you feel you could be better. One final exercise that you might do is to share your conclusions with someone who knows you well. Ask this person if he or she agrees with you that these are your strongest and weakest qualities. The answer could be very helpful to you, and it might even come as a surprise.